Our reading this morning is from Philip Levine's collection entitled What Work Is. It's a fantastic collection of poetry. I recommend it to all of you. And the title of this work is the title from his collection also, What Work Is. We stand in the rain in a long line waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with that same sad slouch. The grin that does not hide the stubbornness. The sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead, a man is waiting who will say, no, we're not hiring today for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now, suddenly, you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind you or ahead because he's home trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him? Held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words and maybe kissed his cheek. You've never done something so simple, so obvious, not because you're too young or too dumb, not because you're jealous or mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No, just because you don't know what work is. Most of you, I'm guessing, do know what work is. Or at least we think we do. I'd like to invite us today to approach that word work with what the Buddhists call beginner's mind, with new eyes, with a blank slate. Throughout the month of November, during our Wellspring events, we will explore together a little bit of what work means to each of us. My hunch is that we each have different definitions and expectations about what work really is. For example, is work something we do just for the money? Is it something more? Many of us devote the majority of our waking hours to this task called work that must, if we do it as much as we do, it must somehow provide some value in our lives. So I ask you, where does that value come from? How have you learned to value your work? From whom did you learn this? Who were your examples? And when we do decide for ourselves what the work of our hours and days and years will be, how are we to know if we've made a good decision? How do we know if what we're doing is what we should be doing? Someone once said to me, find something you love doing and you'll never work a day in your life. That probably sounds familiar to you, right? Yeah. I looked that up and it was surprising to me. It's actually attributed to Confucius. I thought that was interesting. But is that really true? In a world of money and comfort, of luxury and hunger, is it enough simply to love what you do? I think the easy answer is yes, but as adults, our answers may be a little bit more complicated. For example, I've had some really enjoyable jobs over the years that didn't pay squat. Was I happy? I'm not so sure. I've also worked jobs that paid me well and made me miserable. Work that left me feeling divided and conflicted inside. Was that worth it? Again, I'm not so sure. And we've all likely worked a few miserable jobs for miserable pay, the worst combination. but hopefully those don't last too long, unless, of course, they're the only option. Regardless of the unique mixture of personal fulfillment and material reward that might be present in your work life today, finding and choosing your work is likely one of the biggest decisions that you will make in your lifetime. And if you're anything like me, you'll make it more than once. We sing a song each time the children are in here, and we sing them on their way. We sing, "For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are." Really? Really? You think there's a morning star that sings to the universe who we are? That when we're born, someone or something actually knows who we truly are? Can that really be? I'm 33 years old, and I feel like I learn something new about myself every day. I imagine the same holds true for many of you. That consistency of our life song that sounds when we're first born, of our true calling, has long been one of the central assumptions underlying discussions of vocation. It's the idea that there is something that each of us was meant to do, a personal destiny, if you will. Allow me to illustrate this another way. Picture yourself as an acorn. It's kind of hard to do, isn't it? No matter your will, no matter how hard you try or how badly you want it, you can never grow into a pine tree or a rose bush or a rhubarb. You are an acorn. Like it or not, you're going to become an oak. You may grow into a different size or shape of oak. You may find use in the world as a shade tree. You may be ground into paper, or you may provide refuge for furry and winged animals. But one thing is for sure, you are an oak. Your life path will always be that of an oak. This is a metaphorical way of understanding some basic vocational theory. The theory is that our unique biological and psychological hardwiring, our nature compared to our nurture, is irrefutable. Your unique song, that tune that the morning star sang on the day of your creation, it cannot be changed. Only ignored, cannot be muted, only misheard. Your song is your song, like it or not. Just as an acorn can never become a pine, a person can never change their tune, their true calling. If you believe this, then the central task of life becomes listening for that song and then living by its melody, discerning our destiny and then living by it. Or so the theory goes. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of this view. It seems awfully constrictive, and it smacks of Calvinist predestination, the idea that before we are born, some of us are destined for either heaven or hell. While I don't agree with this view, I also can't say that it isn't true or useful. I agree that we are each somewhat predisposed to certain behaviors and interests, genetically, perhaps even spiritually. But I also think that this disposition can change throughout a lifetime, certainly has in mine. When I was 5, like many boys, I wanted to be a firefighter or a robot. When I was 12, I wanted to be a marine biologist. At 16, I pictured myself as a professional trombonist. At 24, I was living large as a business manager. And today, I'm a minister. I'm probably the most fulfilled that I've ever been in my life. But I wonder, has it really been that same stubborn morning star calling me through all these visions of work? How can one consistent song lead me through such distinct dreams and aspirations? Maybe early on I wasn't hearing it right. Or was I not listening? Or was the tune itself changing? Looking back at different times in my life, especially in my early adulthood, I can see plenty of occasions when I just wasn't listening. There were times when I was too busy, and the noise and stress around me would have drowned out any soft heart song of greater calling. There are times when I did hear something, a pleading murmur from within, but I lacked either the courage or resources or both to make the kind of change that perhaps I should have. Yes, there are plenty of times when I wasn't listening, when I was headstrong or ego-driven. But there were other times, too. Times when I was open and ready to hear my tune. Times when I needed to hear that fateful tune, and yet I heard nothing. Perhaps I heard something that sounded so unlike me that I dismissed it, perhaps too quickly. My conclusion, looking back on my life, is this: that there may well be genes and destiny in play when we discern our life's path. Some of our life's motion was undoubtedly given its movement before we arrived and made our first decisions. As interdependent beings, I think there is indeed a limit to our self-determination. But there's also a deep and abiding freedom of mind and spirit that can cause our tune to change over time. The important thing, whether your tune is constant or changing right now, is simply to keep listening. Find something worth dying for and live for it. Surprising, wasn't it? Yeah. It was surprising to me when I heard it when I was 15. You have any guesses as to who gave me that advice? What was that? Grandpa? No. Any other guesses? Teacher, close. Close. ROTC, also close. This was the earnest suggestion of a high school marching band director. Yeah. And while dying for a marching band would seem to many of us adults as perhaps a bit extreme, remember for a minute with me what it was like to be a teenager. Remember when every moment felt huge, when tests, relationships, sports, music, drama, they all felt huge when cast against this ongoing teenage struggle for independence and identity. Whatever you did in your teenage years, whether it was sports or academics, the arts or partying, chances are that it captured you and at times defined you. As adults, our hope is that this momentary intensity, this need to prove ourselves in each moment, fades over time. We find confidence in knowing that it's okay to fail. It's okay to be vulnerable. We learn that our identity is not made or unmade with any momentary success or defeat, and that our freedom asks of us much more than selfishness. Indeed, this is not just my land. It is yours too. And we learn that there is much, so much, that impacts our lives that is beyond our control. In my life, concerns like these, concerns like freedom, will, control, these are most visible and most challenging during moments of great transition in my life, like losing a loved one, becoming a parent, or a job transition. In fact, I think that discernment related to employment can be some of the hardest discernment there is. Because beneath any discussion of mere jobs and ideas, our values and human worth, ideas about dignity and ability, about our role in the larger world. When you begin asking around about becoming a minister, it isn't long before someone asks you about your call. It can seem like a lofty question at first, but what people are asking you is this: what drew you into this work? Why do you feel the task is important enough to receive your time and life's energy? I've often thought it strange and unfortunate that this concept of call is so often limited to clergy. After all, I've known pipe fitters and teachers, farmers and dentists who each felt called to their work. Each supported by tradition and community, they do their work because of a lineage of service and purpose, because they've been given valuable skills, and because they are rewarded financially, emotionally, even spiritually for their effort and labor. I invite you to ask someone sometime why they do what they do. Their answer may surprise you. As for me, I grew up, as you may have guessed by now, as a musician. I've played trombone since I was 10 years old. In high school, I played in every group that I could. Put simply, trombone was my life. When time came for me to go to college, my private instructors and band directors wanted to see me go off to either a conservatory or a large public university with a great music department. Already feeling caged by my trombonist identity, however, I chose a small liberal arts school in rural Pennsylvania. I entered as a music performance major, and after a year, I tacked on a major in business. A few years later, when I looked back and made sense of this decision in a journal, I called it balancing passion and practicality, music and business. I knew then that I loved playing trombone, but I also knew that I didn't want to do it for a living. And so I chose something that I thought was a bit more practical. You see, I grew up in an expensive town in New Jersey, a suburb of New York City. Living there was a stretch for my family, a family that at one time lived in a trailer park in Oklahoma. But my parents moved there for the schools, a decision for which I will always be grateful. I grew up a somewhat naive and idealistic middle-class musician in a well-to-do suburb, and I became accustomed to a certain quality of living there. Ironically, a quality of living not easily supported by the salary of a professional musician. I was living a good life, and I wanted to keep living it. My mother had always said to me, "We just want you to have choices, Jason." Indeed, certainly as a father now, I can relate to that. And ensuring future choices, I think, requires some measure of practicality. But choices are rarely worth choosing if they do not also invoke our life's passions. A few years after college, I found myself working in a job for which I had almost no passion at all. It was a well-paying, outwardly successful job that required long hours and lots of energy. I was able to purchase an apartment, but I was rarely home enough to enjoy it, much less to fill it with friends or family or music. I also succumbed to another danger of job dissatisfaction, too much time spent at happy hour. I left that job because I was self-destructing, and no amount of money is worth that. I'm grateful now that I found the courage to make a change. Again, years later, I looked back on my experiences, and this time I did so while also picking up my horn again. I came upon what has become to me scripture, my very first manuscript notebook from my first trombone teacher. On the first page, he wrote two things. He said, number one, play with reckless abandonment. Number two, play the right notes at the right time with a good tone. Do them in that order, he said. His advice reminds me now of that famous fatherly line from Hamlet, "To thine own self be true." I claim this lesson as scripture now because, like the scriptures of world religions, this is the story by which I've made sense of my experience. It's a parable of integrity amidst difficult decisions, adult decisions. I understand it now to mean that I must first be me. I must be authentic and play from the heart. And then I can worry about putting myself in the context of others. Neither self-absorption nor self-denial work very well for me. This middle way between self and others is where the music of my heart sings true. Well, this middle way between passion and practicality, or even my land and your land, can be especially hard to find these days. I want to talk a minute about some of the observations on why that's the case, but before I do that, Jay, actually, who's around here somewhere, it was his idea to put "This land is your land, this land is my land" in the service, and it was interesting. I looked it up, and Guthrie wrote it as a counterpoint to "God Bless America," you know, the anthem that was done by Kate Smith that he thought would "God bless," you know, that one. It's pretty good, right? I've seen lots of Yankee games, and they put that on in the middle of Yankee games. And I mean no disrespect to it. It's a fantastic anthem. But Guthrie thought that it was a little bit too celebratory at a time when the nation was really struggling. And so especially that last line about seeing people at the relief office and things like that really hits home right now. And part of that is if you looked last month, the U.S. Census released new data on domestic poverty. 46.2 million Americans now live below the poverty line, which translates to nearly one in six. This is the highest number on record in 52 years of poverty estimates. More than every fifth child in this country now lives in poverty. Between 2000 and 2007, all growth in the economy went to the richest 10% of citizens, while the incomes for the bottom 90% actually fell. So we hear often of the demise of the middle class in America. And whenever we tune in these days, we hear news of the Occupy movement. Whether or not you agree with the politics or tactics, I invite you to listen for the deeper message, the deeper cry. Listen for the heartbreak. People today are heartbroken over the state of work. What this movement signals to me, in addition to the obvious growing disparity between rich and poor, is that the rift between passion and practicality, between doing what you love and doing what you have to do to feed your family, is also growing. These trends are stark reminders that a livable balance between passion and practicality is one that's slipping beyond the reach of more and more of us and our neighbors. And when this happens, when gifted people, and we are all gifted, are forced into jobs not of our own choosing that do not offer us growth or integrity, we all suffer. There was a time in our nation's history and in our denomination's history when great minds envisioned a civilization in which passion and practicality were not mutually exclusive opposites, but rather catalytic partners. A civilization in which the gifts of each person could rise, mostly through public education, to full growth and potential and civic contribution. Thomas Jefferson envisioned our young republic becoming what he called a natural aristocracy. He used that word in comparison and contrast to the hereditary monarchy he observed in England. In 1779, he said, "Those persons whom nature hath endowed with genius and virtue should be rendered by liberal education worthy to receive and able to guard the sacred deposit of the rights of their fellow citizens, and should be called to that charge without regard to wealth, birth, or other accidental condition or circumstance." In modern words, our whole society benefits when we find ways for people to use their gifts, when we find ways for all people to contribute meaningfully and freely. In congregational life, we call this shared ministry. Political life, we call it citizenship. And in economic life, we call it work. We call it a calling. We call it vocation. I've come to believe that we each have a calling, that we each can have a place of meaningful contribution in the social order of humankind. Thomas Jefferson believed this, so did the Transcendentalists, part of our legacy or tradition, who we often regard only for their introspection, but who are also deeply interested in the effects of a societal order on the state of the human soul. Theodore Parker referred to calling as a natural desire. Emerson called it self-reliance. Thoreau spoke of its coerced absence famously as the quiet desperation of most men's lives. Unitarian and Universalist congregations since the founding of this nation have been rightfully concerned with a ministry of vocation. And today it should be no different, especially today when millions of Americans face difficult decisions related to employment. Let our congregation, then, this place, be a place of discernment, where we might come to know reckless abandonment in the company and context of our neighbors. Let our congregation be a place of mutual aid and common concern, of study and dialogue and action, where we might come to know how our experiences relate to those around us and why the abundance of our loving creation continues to be so poorly distributed. Let our congregation be a place of worth, where we come to know our value in the deep love of one another, not in the shallow whims of a market If any of you were here for Reverend Walker's address last week, her sermon said that we have good news. This is certainly true. I understand our good news to be this. Everyone has value in our midst. CEO, carpenter, professional athlete, teacher, everyone has equal value here. We may indeed be adults now. We may be beyond the need for immediate affirmations, beyond proving ourselves every day. But none of us is beyond the need to feel loved, to feel valued. None of us is beyond the need for meaning and purpose in our lives. You all know what work is. Deep down, you know what work is. And you know why it has become so lifeless, so alienating for so many. My challenge to us today is to lead from that awareness, from that place of heartbreak. Let us dare one another as citizens and neighbors to find work once again, to find meaning in work once again, to build a social order that values work and workers. Work is not a means to an end. Work itself is important. My charge to us as individuals is to awaken once again to the still small voice within. The voice that speaks to us of calling and vocation. The voice that speaks to us in the instinctual language of the heart. Listen. And let your life speak. We may not all find jobs that we would die for, but together we can build a social order in which none of us need risk death, spiritual or physical, just to make a living. Such a world, as has been the promise of our religion for many hundreds of years, would truly be a blessing upon us all. May it be so, and amen.